At summer camp, the third and fourth graders love this game called What Time Is It, Mr. Fox? And it's basically a tag game. Mr. Fox stands all by himself or herself at one side of the field, and players line up in a big line and try and get closer and closer to the fox without getting tagged by the fox, without getting eaten by the fox. And the child who gets closest, and you have to be quiet so that the fox doesn't know you're sneaking up on him, the child who gets closest to the fox usually has to sneak up and figure out some sort of strategy. Usually it's a quieter kid who gets closer to the fox because the noisier kids get caught earlier. It's fun to watch the kid who gets closest because they start to get the giggles, they start to get the shakes, they start to get like really excited because at any moment, Mr. Fox, who is not watching you, who is turned the other way, turned away from you, cannot see you, and so you are almost up on the person's shoulder, you're almost ready to tag them, but if they turn around, and there are points in the game where they are allowed to turn around, then you're out. And so the child anticipates this moment of what time it is, and it's quite an exciting moment for them. And this game got me to sort of start thinking about how different life would be, human life would be, if we all know what time it really was. The game's called What Time Is It, Mr. Fox? Because Mr. Fox tells you the time of how many steps you can take. It's 2 o'clock, you take 2 steps. It's 4 o'clock, you take 4 to get closer to him. But how would human life be different if we knew what time it really was? If we knew how close we were to fulfilling Jesus' words in Matthew 28, the Great Commission, where Jesus says, go baptize all nations in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, make disciples. Lo, I am with you always to the end of the age. I wonder what that would mean if we knew how close we are to fulfilling that promise. Now, there are Christians in all nations, and some people thought a generation or two ago that we had reached the end of the Great Commission. But when you go and dig down a little bit deeper, people realized in the 70s that that's not really what Jesus said or meant. There are plenty of places around the world that have never heard of Jesus because of geographic, they're so isolated that they have never heard of Jesus, or because they live in an oppressive society, a society where Christians are persecuted. That there are people that are just isolated for various other ethnic or religious reasons. So there are people who have never heard of Jesus in some microcultures, some tribes in Nepal or Mongolia or China or Bangladesh or Syria. It's estimated today, 2018, that there are 2 billion people on an earth of 7 and some billion people without access to the gospel or without access to a Christian church or access to a Christian, that they have no way of knowing who a Christian is. That's not that they just don't know a Christian. It's they don't have access because they are so remote. They are so separated. And so that's a pretty big gap, I think. 2 billion people. But I wonder what it would mean to us if we knew what time it was, if we knew how close we were to fulfilling the Great Commission, if we knew how close we were to fulfilling Abraham's promise. God makes the promise to Abraham that you will be a blessing to all nations, and that is the basis for Matthew 28, that through Abraham, Matthew 28 will happen. Through Abraham, all nations will become followers of Jesus Christ. And I wonder what that means. I wonder what would happen if we knew what time it was to fulfill the Great Commission. If we knew we were only 10 years out, would that change your understanding of politics or your own personal life? Or if you heard that we were only 30 years out, what would happen if we knew that the evangelization of the whole world would be possible in our lifetimes? Would that change us? Would that make us more energetic if we knew where the goalposts were? I think it might, but I'm not sure. Would it change how our Christian churches spend money? And would we stand there if we knew that the goal was in sight, if we knew that it was possible to reach every group, every ethnic group, every tribe, every people with the gospel? Would we stand there like the child playing What Time Is It, Mr. Fox, kind of giddy, kind of exciting, waiting for that moment to touch Mr. Fox, to tag him on the shoulder? And the promise of Matthew 28 has its roots in the promise and covenant that God makes with Abraham back in Genesis 12. The promise that God makes that all people will be blessed through Abraham. And since Abraham is an ancestor of Jesus, and we are spiritually descended from Jesus through the church, one day all the world will have full access to the gospel. And when that day happens, the promise will finally come true. That seems like an exciting time. That seems like an exciting promise. But I wonder, not only if we know what time it is, and I don't think we do, but I wonder the contrast with Abraham as well. What time was it for Abraham? You see, Abraham didn't grow up in the faith. We're told very specifically in Genesis 12 that he grew up in a different faith, and that this moment when God comes and speaks to him is abrupt. God comes to Abraham, who is this merchant, who is wealthy, who is minding his own business, who has just been introduced a few verses earlier in Genesis, and God says to Abraham, the first words out of God's mouth to Abraham, go from your country, go from your people, and go from your father's house. I would propose to you that what Abraham ends up doing is much harder than what we are told to do. That what Abraham ends up doing is much more difficult because Abraham had no idea what time it was. Because this is more than just loading up your U-Haul and moving from Murraysville to Arkansas. This is much bigger than that. This is much bigger than that because God says, I want you to give up your country. Abraham already has a life back in Haran. He's got a country. He has learned what it is to be a good citizen of that nation. And God says, I want you to pick up and go to a land that I will show you. Start walking, and I will tell you when to stop. Do you see how crazy that might have sounded? Do you see how crazy that might have sounded to Abraham? And then when Abraham says, oh yeah, God, I'll do that. Do you see how crazy that might have sounded to Sarah? And to the rest of the servants and the rest of the extended family that gets up and starts walking. So Abraham has to give up his patriotism and his flag in order to follow God. And God says, not only are you to leave your country, you're supposed to leave your people, the friends that you grew up with, your ethnic traditions. I don't know what kind of ethnic traditions they would have had back then. This is in deep, deep, deep dark history, ancient history. But imagine if you had to give up one of your favorite ethnic traditions. Imagine if you had to give up one of your favorite family traditions. You always get together on Christmas Eve with your family. You can never do that again because you're going someplace where they don't celebrate that. And then God says, you have to give up your people and your religion and your idols. You have to give up all that so that you can worship me. And finally, God says to Abraham, you've got to give up your father's house. You've got to leave dad's house. Now, Abraham's 75 at this point. I don't know how old dad was, but in any event, what does that mean? That means stability. That means that Abraham has to give up a bank account and an inheritance. He's got to give all that up. Now, that might not be hard when you're 18 and you're thinking of going off to college and you're thinking of striking out on your own, but Abraham isn't leaving for a promise of a better job. Abraham is not leaving for a promotion. Maybe you and I could give all that up if we thought that the land we were living in was terrible and there was a famine and there were awful things going on and we thought we could make a better life someplace else. But that's not the case here. Abraham is perfectly happy and contented in Haran. Abraham leaves for one reason and one reason only. And that's because God makes him a promise. Abraham leaves on the basis of a promise that God will make of him a great nation, that he will be a blessing to all people on the earth. At 75 years old, he will inherit a new land, which we find out later is called Canaan, which we translate into the promised land or into the nation of Israel. And I would propose to you that it is tough to leave for a promise, especially when all that Abraham can see with his eyes is there are only advantages to staying home. There's safety in numbers and not striking out on your own. There's family to rely on back in Haran. He's got a support system. The promise here is what is so important. Because the promise to Abraham that God will protect him, that God will make him a blessing, that God will be with him, becomes the basis for the rest of the Bible. God in the Bible makes promises over and over and over again. The promise becomes the basis for the rest of the Bible. The promise becomes the basis for the history of the church. The people who built Emmanuel Reformed United Church of Christ believed the promise of God that this patch of ground could be a place where the gospel would be preached, where the hungry would be fed, where the poor are served. At one point, to put up this church would have seemed like crazy talk. On the top of a hill, you've got a bunch of trees, you've got to clear it, you've got to put in all sorts of infrastructure, you've got to make sure that people can get here. Who's going to come? Do you know how many people they had at the first worship service at Hills Church? That we think the number of people that we had at the first worship service in 1828 was 31 people. 31 people built a structure. Now, it wasn't this structure. It was a little log cabin and that kind of thing. But can you imagine if we had 31 people and we said, hey, we'd like to build a new building, we'd get laughed out of here, right? People would say, nah, that ain't enough people. That's not going to happen. But somebody believed the promise that if you build it, remember that movie Field of Dreams? If you build it, people will come. They will come. If you believe your eyes over the promise, you'll never do it. If you believe your eyes over the promise of God, you'll never do it. Two things can happen to you if you believe your eyes over the promise of God. If you believe your eyes over the promise of God, the first thing is you can go internally and you can start despairing. That somehow, if we believe our eyes over the promise, therefore God isn't listening to me. Somehow, I'm going to despair because I don't believe that God really has my best interests at heart. I hear this all the time. The church situation in the United States today is a situation of despair. In the United States, on average, 10 Christian churches close per day. And when you talk to people, when you talk to clergy, my colleagues, when you talk to consistory presidents, there is a deep sense of despair. How could God let this happen? Sometimes it's a personal despair that God doesn't care about my life. God doesn't care about me. When we forget the promise. And the promise is that the church will be a blessing, whatever shape and whatever form it takes. That we will be a blessing through Abraham and through Jesus, whatever shape and what form we take. So despair should not enter into it. The other alternative, the other thing that happens when you look at your eyes rather than the promise of God is external. You start looking around, you don't despair, but you start envying. You don't believe in God's promise because you believe that somehow you've been given the short end of the stick. That somehow you're jealous or envious of what other people have. You envy the person who has power over you, the person who is more attractive than you, the person who is smarter than you, quicker than you, more athletic than you. And since you will always find somebody who does something better than you, the possibilities of the sin of envy are practically limitless. So those are the two things we face. We can either believe in God's promise and go out with confidence, or we can let ourselves become victims of envy and despair. And so I ask you again, what time is it? Do you know what time it really is? It's not the time for retreat. It's not the time for us to say, you know what, it's time to pack it in. It's not the time to say, you know what, the church is never going to rise again or Christian faith is done. It's a time to say, I believe in the promise. I believe in a God who makes promises and keeps his promises. The promise is that Christian ministry is the good news of Jesus. The promise is that Christian ministry is worthwhile, that it will bear fruit, that it does bear fruit, that we will be involved in the saving of souls, and that someday every nation will be reached with the gospel, that every people group will have a church, will have Christians, will have peace. What time is it? The good news, my friends, is that it is time for us to get to work. And it is time for us to hear God's promise and to live in the joy of that promise. Amen.